Okay, today is 10-10-11. I think the recorder is working, and let me begin by thanking my graduate students who stepped in for me and gave lectures last week. Apologies for my absence. I was at the National Academy of Sciences in Washington, D.C., chairing a committee there, so often takes up my time. So today we'll move ahead. We're on to lecture 7 now, and I want to talk about map generalization. What did we see in the last two lectures? If you remember, last time you heard from me, we were talking about map projections, that next transformation. Projections, as we saw, allow us to be able to give references to the planar map space using coordinate systems. And we went over a whole bunch of them, or I hope you went over a whole bunch of them, including things like the military grid reference system, the universal transverse Mercator system, the national grid, and so on and so on. There are plenty of them. We're going to meet some of them in labs, and you're going to become quite familiar with them. Then in the last lecture, we should have looked at land partitioning systems, the systems by which we divide up the landscape. When I flew back, the week before last, I flew directly over that part of Ohio that you saw in the one slide. We could see the sort of mishmash of dozens of different land partitioning systems all piled up next to each other. And it was beautifully crystal clear that day, and I could actually see on the landscape the pattern that was being revealed there. So today we move on. What we're going to do today is really go back and reconsider that the transformation we've already looked at, the very first one, the scale transformation. And during that transformation, we primarily talked about the representative fraction and how to calculate map scale. Today I want to sort of lecture in a little bit more general sense. I want to ask the question, what happens to maps when we go through the generalization transformation? And the generalization transformation is going from a very detailed map with a lot of content to a far less detailed map, like a map of the entire Earth. Obviously the information content is going to be different. So let's just do a get familiar exercise first. What is this problem? Well, if you've used Google Earth or Google Maps or any of the online mapping services, you've probably done exactly this. So I've zoomed right into Campus Point here using, I believe it's Google Earth, yes, into an exact location, and we'll start at that particular point. What we're looking at is an image. Notice that we've got a grid located on here, so that's one of the grid systems that we've already been working with. So let's move through. What I'm throwing up now is the data from the digital elevation model. That's the finite resolution terrain data, the heights data that we have for this region. And you notice that if we start at this zoomed in scale that we just saw in Google Earth, we're at the equivalent map scale of about 1 to 1,550. And we don't see a heck of a lot of detail, both in range of color, because we don't have much variation in terrain height, but also we can see that the data look blocky. So the ground distance associated with any one of these pixels begins to look pretty finite. It's an actual spot on the ground that's so many meters by so many meters. Let's zoom back. Now we're at 1 to 6. 1,227. These are completely arbitrary. I had to calculate these. And you can see that, yes, the campus sits on a little mesa above the surrounding area, and it's got this big feature carved into it that we call the lagoon. It's actually surrounded by bluffs. And the reason why that's so deeply incised is it used to be an asphalt mine, was for many years. It was discontinued in the 1940s and very much deepened during that period. We zoom out a little bit further, 1 to 12,450, about half the scale of the topographic map. Now we can see the campus and the continued mesa out into Isla Vista. We can see the Devereaux Slough in terms of its topography. Notice that we're getting a slightly higher range in topography being shown and a much larger extent. The scale on the left-hand side, by the way, is the full range of colors over the elevations. Zoom back again, 1 to 24,910. We're pretty much beginning to pick up some of the foothills are showing up in brighter colors. You can see the whole low-lying area of Goleta that's going to be susceptible to tsunamis if we get a big one in this area. 1 to 46,390, we're getting close to that 1 to 50,000 scale. We zoom back, and we can see Santa Barbara, or at least the mesa. The creek here that leads out to Henry's Beach. And now we go all the way out to beyond Devereux Slough on the other side, and we carry up to the foothills. So 1 to 50,000, that's a pretty big chunk of real estate. We go almost up to the foothills down to the ocean, and from Gully to Santa Barbara, that's about 10 or 12 mile drive. We come out again, now we're at 1 to 89,060, and we can see that the coastal plain is really just exactly that. It's a flat area here, and we've got a series of valleys incised into the Santa Ynez Mountains. And beyond the Santa Ynez Mountains, we've got Lake Kachuma, good trout fishing over there, but we've got a mountain range. If we come out again, now we're at 1 to 172,000, approximately 73. Now we can see all of the topography for the second range and the much higher, for the valley, the Santa Ynez Valley and the much higher second range. You can see Paradise Valley and Red Rock and so on, all that good recreation area up behind Santa Barbara. Now we're at 1 to 344,000. We can see the whole, what many might call the south coast. And we see that the lowlands here are echoed here in Carpinteria, parts of Santa Barbara, and out here on the coast by the Guadalupe Dunes, and then up towards Vandenberg Air Force Base and beyond. So now we're seeing a pretty significant chunk of real estate. If we go to about 1 to 500,000, notice that I don't have data anymore to show topography. I go over to hill-shaded relief, and I go over to the kinds of scales. Here I'm in the National Map Viewer, the USGS system that allows you to see topographic maps that they make available to the country. And we begin to notice that now we're looking at a pretty significant chunk of Southern California at 1 to 500,000. Certainly the whole LA Basin and all the way up to Bakersfield and so on beyond it. If we go to the last of the scales the USGS deals with, it's about 1 to 2 million. There's data from the National Atlas that we're now looking at. And indeed, we can see pretty much the whole southwestern United States in this image. We come out to about 1 to 5 million equivalent, and we're seeing pretty much all of North America and a fairly good chunk of Central and South America. Okay, so this is just to put kinds of scales in the frame of mind to get you thinking about scales. So what happens while we've done this zoom? It's really easy to do these zooms with the digital mapping programs. Okay, Google Maps, we can zoom right into the street level, we can pull right out again, very simply, just with a few clicks of the mouse. In fact, you can actually click on a point in Google Earth and use the wheel on your mouse to zoom in and out. Makes you a little giddy sometimes, but you can do it. So what happens? Well, first of all, we go from detailed when we're zoomed all the way in to much more generalized when we zoom out. On the map at 1 to 5 million, when we saw the whole United North of North America, we certainly couldn't see Isla Vista. It's just too small to be considered of interest at that level of detail. So we get features dropping off the map, and they disappear completely. That's one of the issues I want to look at. It's called simplification, and I've got a few slides to illustrate that today. We can go from jaggies, as we saw in the very first digital terrain model image, where we were zoomed in so far we could see individual pixels on the ground, to blurry when we can no longer see the features because they're just at a scale where the labels are not even going to be readable, or we can't even detect the symbols that are being shown. The extent increases, definitely increases. The amount of real estate we're showing on the map increases quite significantly, and the consequences of that we now know from the work we've done on projections and coordinate systems is we put more and more distortion into the map as we show a bigger and bigger chunk of the Earth's surface. We're showing up the plane surface. The Earth's surface is not a plane. We all now know it's an oblate ellipsoid, and the variance for that we have to deal with. So the Earth model, the one that we choose, matters a great deal more. We have different levels of interpretation are possible, so we could decide to put something on or not decide to put something on. I'll talk about selection and how it works in just a second. And it becomes harder and harder to convert measurements with the representative fraction. Just think about the margin of error that you could associate with a map measurement at, say, 1 to 5 million versus 1 to 5,000. If you're off by, you know, half a millimeter, it makes an enormous difference on the ground given those two conversions. All right. So, as I said, we typically choose standard map scales on which to make our coverages, and then we go ahead and make the complete coverage for the whole country, or in many cases, the whole world. These are the scales we'll meet regularly. I showed you this list before, but I'll trim it a little bit. These are the scales the U.S. Geological Survey uses for its topographic maps. 1 inch to 2,000 feet, 1 to 24,000. The lower 48 states are finished, but not Alaska. Hawaii is, for some reason. 1 to 50,000 is the scale that the former Defense Mapping Agency, now the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, uses for its mapping. So there are worldwide maps at 1 to 50,000. And 1 to 50K is a very commonly chosen scale. Mexico's mapped at 1 to 50K. Canada's mapped at 1 to 50K. That's the national scale that they chose. 1 to 100K, that's where we had the first continuous coverage of the entire United States at 1 to 100,000. The original digital line graphs done for the U.S. Census Bureau in collaboration with the USGS. Then we've got these two bizarre scales, the old 1 to 63,360, the inch to 1 mile scale, that the USGS attempted to metrify at 1 to 62,500. Those are the legacy scales that we use for Alaska. The maps of Alaska at those scales. And the 250, 500, we begin to see these and become familiar with them. But the 1 million we've mentioned in class several times. And the 1 to 2 million, the National Atlas, is probably the coarsest maps that get made of the United States. But what that says, those are kind of fixed scales, and we kind of know what's going to be on the map at those scales. What features are going to be shown on the map, and what features are going to be labeled. Those are the two things that are really pretty important. Whether a surface street is going to be shown, whether only a major highway is going to be shown, whether a city is going to be labeled, these are the decision points. As we zoom back into a feature, then the hidden data that's at the more detailed scale can be presented to the user. And so if we zoom in on Isla Vista, on the left-hand side at a fairly coarse scale, we can see just a gray blob where all of the IV and the campus is located. We zoom in on IV, we see each street, and each street is labeled. So there's hidden information that's triggered by a certain key scale. When we cross that key scale on the digital system, we're getting more information. When we zoom back out to the scale that's beyond that, we lose the information. It's not going to be depicted within that scale range. Okay, so here's the bottom line. This is the key slide to today's lecture. What happens as we generalized? Okay, well, at least these five things happen, and they all have enormous consequences for cartometry, or making of measurements from maps, something we're going to do in detail from now on in the next few labs. So I'll just tell you what they are for now briefly. I'm going to go over them one by one, make sure you understand just exactly what it is they are. So selection, what does that mean? Well, it means that when we have a coarse map, we can't show everything that's going to be on the detailed map, so we have to pick what we're going to show. Are we only going to show cities over 100,000 population? Only going to show capital cities? We have to have some basis for judgment on how to select what to show. Simplification, when we draw on a fine scale map, we can be very detailed about how we represent features. We can put every little wiggle in a political boundary or a highway or on a creek. But when we zoom all the way out and we're dealing with coarse map, if we tried to include all that level of detail, we'd just see a fuzzy blur where the feature was going to be. So we have to say, how do we simplify that road, or how do we simplify that railroad or a water feature, so that we can still see that it's a water feature without so much detail? Combination is kind of a tricky one. I'll give you a couple of examples, but it basically means that as we generalize, as the map becomes more and more general, it's harder and harder to recognize individual features. It's much more important to represent the characteristic of a feature than an individual feature. I'll show you an example using Hawaii here in just a second. Displacement is probably the hardest one to understand of all, because it actually involves distorting the map, the same way a map projection does. Deliberately distorting the map, telling a cartographic lie. Okay, and I'll explain why we have to do that in just a minute. And then the last one that I'll cover without much detail is exaggeration. Often we have to exaggerate features to make them visible. And we do so quite frequently within cartography. All right, so let's go on and look at these. And I've chosen as our reference a wonderful little place called Simplicity, Virginia, which I've been researching for my textbook. Simplicity, right? Simplicity. Quick spot quiz. 17SQB 2898706830 is a coordinate reference in what coordinate reference system? Military grid? National grid? Both correct. Remember, military grid and the national grid, identical in only in everything except only one aspect. That's the datum that they use. Okay, military grid's based on WGS 84, the national grid's based on NAD 83. Alright, simplicity, Virginia. How the heck did this ever get on the map to begin with? Well, as far as I can tell, 100 years ago, somebody filed an application for a post office in Simplicity, Virginia, and it was approved. Why the heck it was approved? I don't know, because I've zoomed in and looked around, and apparently there are one, two, perhaps three buildings in Simplicity, Virginia. One of them's for sale. I doubt it costs very much. but there just is nothing there. It's a whistle stop. It's a one intersection on this highway. Okay, but somehow it got approved as a place name, and it's very interesting to see where that place name was picked up. Okay, it's an official place, what's called a populated place in the USGS databases and in the census databases. So here it is down on Google Earth. We can see that there's not much there. When we go over and look at it on the two maps, we can see that there it is, the place name. It's associated with that street intersection. I've got two different maps here, by the way. On the right-hand side is the standard U.S. Geological Survey map as a paper map. Okay, these maps were produced over many years, starting in the 1950s through about 3 or 4 years ago when the USGS decided that they were never going to print another paper map. Okay, these were paper. When they were released to the public in digital form, they simply ran them through scanners and produced what are called the digital raster graphics. And there's something called the Libra project that does LibreOffice and stuff like that. Libra map makes available all of these maps for the entire country. You can just download them from the website. There's rather large GeoTIFF files. Okay, so that's the map the way it was basically in the 80s or 90s from most of the country. On the left-hand side is the way it appears on the GeoPDF file formats, the new equivalents that the USGS uses for its projects. Now, in the labs to come up, we're going to be meeting the GeoPDF toolbar, the tool that allows you to pop up maps, open them, click on things, get coordinates, measure distances, measure areas, do all sorts of cool stuff. It makes life very easy. But it doesn't have nearly as much detail. As you can see, there's fewer features. It's got the main cultural features, the roads and so on. It's got the hydrography and the topography, the contour lines, but not a heck of a lot else. Okay, so here we are at 1 to 24,000, and if we go to that location, we can find a place called Simplicity. Okay, so why don't we start with that and just keep enlarging it? Well, the problem is, as you enlarge stuff, let's say we enlarge it, so this is the old problem. Imagine take a sheet of paper that's perfectly crisp, put it on the Xerox machine, make a copy, take the copy, put that on the Xerox machine, press the button, and keep going. By the time you get to about a hundredth copy, you can't even read what's on the copy, okay? Because it's just so blurry and disorganized. Same thing happens on a computer screen. As we click enlarge, 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 zoom, 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 eventually we just run up against the pixels that were stored in the visual database. That's exactly what happens here. So if I keep zooming on Simplicity in the GeoPDF toolkit, I end up with a very fuzzy Simplicity, okay? Simplicity is becoming very fuzzy or complex. So just enlarging doesn't work. It's not going to give us what we need. So let's take a look at Simplicity on intermediate scales. On the left-hand side is the paper map version of the 1 to 250,000 USGS quadrangle series. And it's gone. Okay? There is no Simplicity on this map. On the right-hand side, we see the equivalent in the National Atlas. National Atlas is a series of web portals that allow you to go in and browse all the course-level national data for the United States. And you zoom in on that part of Virginia, and there is no Simplicity in that either. So Simplicity is gone at intermediate scales. You might say life is becoming more complex. If we go to OpenStreetMap, what's OpenStreetMap? Well, started in the United Kingdom. A couple of guys decided that they didn't like the Crown copyright on the British Ordnance Survey maps because it's very strict. You're not allowed to copy them or use them the way you can maps that the US government produces here under sort of open freedom of access. So they said, well, people got GPSs in their cars, and everybody's got a GPS receiver now. Why don't we just set up a portal that allows people to check in their tracks as they drive around or move around the country, and we'll use this to make a street map of the whole world. Well, that was like 5 years ago. In the five intermediate years, an enormous quantity of information has been added to this. You can, if you want to, you can still go into OpenStreetMap and open up the what are called the user diaries or the input streams, and you can see the data coming in from people's commutes to work all over the world. So here's the coverage of simplicity in OpenStreetMap, and there's the same road intersections, and there's a marker that takes me there to the geographic location, and everything's in the approximate location, but nothing's there. Why? This is user-contributed data, so you might say it's more accurate. It doesn't reflect the fact that some arbitrary post office was named Simplicity and put in this location. So different scales and different coverages are going to give us different types of generalization on maps. If we go to very coarse scales, and here we're using OpenStreetMap to zoom out on their viewer and see what data is available. Again, no simplicity in this. It just gets coarser and coarser. And as you can see, by the time we're onto a world map, in what's clearly a Mercator projection, we've lost all the details other than the names of the countries and the few major cities. Okay, so this is simplification at its best, leaving stuff out to make maps possible. It's selection at the best, leaving stuff out. Now, one word on selection before we go on to the next topic, and that is that we have to have some kind of rule to apply when we go through the process of selection. So if we simply say, you know, as we go to this scale, we're only going to take cities of a certain size, or we're only going to take highways that have a state designation number or whatever it might happen to be. Okay, that's applying a rule. Another rule that could be applied is we'll only label features if there's enough space to label them on the map. Okay, now that's a bit of an arbitrary rule, and that's very commonly applied. You flip open any atlas or any major map of the world, go to any website, and you'll see that rule, that's the usual rule that's applied. So in this map of Canada, for example, right here, I believe this is one of the CIA maps of Canada, now you'll see that it has a series of places labeled. Okay, it's Churchill, Manitoba. I've actually been there. Trust me, it's not that big. So we have labels for, let's say, Dawson City, with a population of 1,327, and Montreal, with a population of 1,620,693. And they're given exactly the same amount of precedent. They're given the same size feature, and they're shown with the same size symbol on the map. Now, why? Because we've got enough room to put the features on the map, because Dawson City is way out there in the north of on Yukon and the border here with Alaska. I believe it's part of Nunavut these days. So selection comes with a price. You know, what rules are we going to apply as we select features to be put on the map? Talked about simplification. Simplification simply means as I've got less and less space in which to draw something because I'm generalizing, I can't draw every level of detail. I can't draw all the wiggles and bends in the feature. I have to make it simpler and simpler. So imagine that as we're losing points, and the number of points being shown is shown on the bar on the left-hand side. This is the counties of Michigan. Imagine that we're zooming out. As we lose the points, you see that all sorts of things begin to happen. Now watch the boundaries in the UP, as they call it in Michigan, the Upper Peninsula, and you'll see that one county, the one with a sort of skinny section in it, actually divides into two at one point, which is sort of completely wrong, completely arbitrary. So how we go about generalization, obviously very important. Bear in mind the super simplified version, that version just before the switch there, we're going to draw in a little tiny, you know, postage stamp space on the map, but you know, having it correct is obviously very important. So simplification, here it's being applied to area features, but we can apply it to all sorts of different features. Here it's being applied to hydrological features. This is out of the National Hydrological Database, which is a database the USGS maintains for all the water features in the entire country, separate database. So here we've got the same thing. On the top, we see it at the equivalent scale, at the very detailed scale. On the left, we've got the hill-shaded topography and the roads added in. That's the little town of Bend, Texas, in the middle. And you'll see that if we just pull up the hydrography, here the river's being represented as a line. Here it's being represented as an area. Okay, so we've got more detail here. And you can see that right in front of Bend, there's two islands in the river. Okay. If we then begin to zoom out, you'll see that at the next level of zoom out, those two islands are still here, still visible, even though we've generalized the map quite considerably. When we go to the next level of detail, here's Bend, the islands have disappeared. Okay, we've represented the area feature now by a single blue line on the map. So what was a body of water has now just become a line symbol. Okay, you could say that area features collapse onto line features and then get infinitely thin until they disappear altogether as we can become more and more generalized on the map. This is the essence of simplification. The individual wiggles and bends, the details, the inlets and outlets and so on become quite simplified as we move on. Okay, combination, as I said, is a little harder to explain, but let me give it a shot. If you ever see, say, a tourist-style map, this isn't a tourist map, it's actually a map of the volcanoes of Hawaii. You see that we've got these major ones on the Big Island, three of them. We have one on Maui, Haleakala. Fantastic place, wonderful. If you want to go from sea level to almost 11,000 feet in about 30 minutes, if your car is up to it, it's probably the only place in the United States where you can do it. The road just goes straight up. And you can rent a bike to ride down, by the way, afterwards, which I wouldn't recommend unless you got really fantastic brakes. But let's go down the island chain. There's Honolulu, there's Oahu, and we'll go out to Niihau, okay? The last of the islands. Well, actually, it's not the last of the islands, but we've made the last of the islands disappear. And if we blow that up now, okay, so here's the generalized version of it, in which Niihau is shown as a single island at the end of the Hawaiian chain. If we zoom right in on it in the USGS map, and notice this is not the national map, this is the GeoTIFF, we'll see that surrounding Niihau Island, which is part of Kauai County, we have not one, two, three islands, all of which count as part of the same island. So when we display this as a single island, those three islands have disappeared. We don't mind combining three islands into one because it's obvious to the reader that these are just a chain of islands, right? So combining islands together, losing detail, is a very common way of being able to make it look as though it's still an island chain, but to lose the detail of individual islands that are probably going to be too small to put on the generalized map. Here's another example of combination, and it literally is sort of a form of cartographic falsehood. It's a source of lying. I've been looking up and researching this place, Fairhope, Alabama. Just an amazing place. This was bought by an individual who decided he was going to buy the land outright and then have fixed tax parcels that he would sell to individuals, and the land taxation scheme would remain solely by the size of the land and never change. And it hasn't changed since that, and over the 100 years that the settlement's been in place. Kind of cool. On the left-hand side, we see it on the GeoTIFF map at 1 to 24,000. You notice we've got the red tone that represents the urban area, and then this sort of pinkish purple that represents expansion, the map revisions. So the city was a bit bigger, and they had to put that on the map. But let me point out something down the middle. There is something called, I believe it's the Big Mouth Gully that goes through the middle here. And that northern blob is a separate community. It's not part of the original Fairhope community. We go over to the next scale. Now we've generalized up to 1 to 250,000. We take that and enlarge it. We've got the rectangle there. It's the equivalent area to that one. Now where's the division gone between the two settlements? It's disappeared entirely. The two settlements with two separate names have become a single blob that represents Fairhope. Okay, we've lost the detail. We've combined urban settlements together. Even though they have separate identities, they're separated by, in this case, a canyon. They're considered to be the same community on the more generalized map. This is combination at its best. Hey, this is how it works. Now, combination and simplification work kind of hand in hand. One of my colleagues I've been working with USGS, Cindy Brewer and Babs Buttonfield, have been looking at how simplification takes place on hydrologic features as maps become more and more generalized. So on the left-hand side, we've got all the immense detail that's in the National Hydrographic Database. Every single little stream and creek is shown there. And then we have this large water body, and we ask ourselves, how do these places fit together? How do they adjoin? Notice that a water body has to have a center line. So if it's in part of a stream network, it has to be represented as a line as well as an area, which can be quite detailed. If we're going to generalize this, okay, so if instead of that much real estate in which to display the map, we've only got this much, we obviously have to simplify it, throw stuff away. So here we've lost some of the finer detail streams. We've actually created parts of streams, and in some cases we've actually created new parts of streams and combined others together to make those legible. And then we've got the blue outline, or the blue solid area that represents the water bodies themselves, and that's been simplified as well, although it looks less so. It is in fact also simplified. So when the generalization process takes place, we've got this complicated idea that we need to maintain some features but not lose other features. We can combine some things and simplify others, but we're always having to judge this issue of how much generalization is enough and how much do we want to go through. Okay, so let's go through the last of these, and this is the idea of displacement, probably the hardest to explain, so bear with me here. What do we do in displacement? Well, we're looking at actually two maps here. Now, this took me forever to do with Photoshop and learning all about transparent overlays and stuff in GIMP. In the sort of foreground, or the detailed looking lines, are the lines from the national map, the 1 to 24,000 equivalent. In the background, looking fairly fuzzy, and enlarged to be the same size, so you can see that the black lines have to be much thicker because they were ordinary thickness lines on the map, but I've blown them up to be equivalent. I've superimposed the map from 1 to 250,000. Okay, so let's take a look. What have we got here? Well, here's a road represented on the 24K, this thin line. Here's that same road, a red line with black boundaries on the 1 to 24,000 map. And you see that's pretty well lined up, works rather well. We can see that. Some other features like this red line, which is part of the Township and Range Survey System, also lines up pretty well. But what happens as we approach the junction up there? Notice that we've got a major road and a very minor road. This is a dirt trail here, adjacent to each other, and parallel. Now what happens as we get towards the junction up here? You'll notice that the dirt track stays the same distance from the highway, but the line on the more coarse map starts to get further and further away from the highway, as if somebody had deliberately moved it. Well, they have. They've deliberately moved those two lines further and further apart so that the actual space on the map, because on the map we're actually talking about maybe this much of the map, it's legible. So we've displaced the feature so that the features become legible. It's a darn right cartographic lie. We're not telling the truth. We measure the width. It's not going to work anymore. Let's look at an example that's even closer to home. I would hazard a guess that every single person in this room has at least once driven along Highway 217 to get to the campus. Right? So here's Highway 217. There's the trailer park with its own lake. You can buy a trailer in there for about $350,000, by the way. Incredible. There's more mesa, deer here. Here's the outlet of the water body out towards Goleta Beach, and here's the highway interchange that deals with the airport. Here's the sewage plant. Very important location if you live on campus. And there's the end of the airport runway. And here we see the same two features on the this is the 1 to 250,000 quad. Okay, the black line with red over it is the highway. The blue line is this feature, the canal, that runs alongside it. Okay, you notice that on the coarse map, it's kind of hard to tell them apart. It's almost as if they're drawn right on top of each other. There is Highway 217, just, oh boy, that's an old photograph, but that's the view you get from the aircraft coming in to approach Santa Barbara Airport. Okay, so let's pop it up into the national map, and let's do some measurements. Let's actually do some cartometry. Okay, remember the GeoPDF viewer. Oh, actually, I'm sorry, I did this in Google Earth, sorry. We can look at, here's Highway 217, here's the central barrier, this is the southbound traffic here, here's the canal. I can actually measure the distance from one end to the other, and I haven't actually stopped my car and paced across there to see if it's actually correct, but it comes out as 10 meters from the edge of the tarmac to the canal, the start of the water in the canal. So let's do the same thing at with the Corsa scale map. Okay, there's the map on the left. Here's the map for reference. Here I had the map scanned and I brought it as an image into Google Earth and just placed it behind, moved it around with the corners of the image until it was perfectly registered with the Earth, and then froze it. Now Google Earth allows you to fade the saturation in and out, so you can see the map or the real world and judge the two. So 10 meters at 1 to 100,000, that's the scale of the map on the left, comes out as 0.1 millimeters, okay, which, as we all know, is about the width of a human hair. It's beyond the limits at which humans can discern differences in lines. You wouldn't be able to see two lines that were 0.1 millimeter apart. You wouldn't be able to detect any difference at all in those two lines. So what do? We just move the lines apart. So on the 1 to 100,000 series map, we take the highway and the canal, and we separate them. We make a gap between them. We exaggerate the gap between the canal and the water and the road. If we actually make the measurement on the map, it comes out to 200 meters. So there's 200 meters of mystery land, or at least 190 meters of mystery land between the canal and the highway. Is it really there? No. Don't go out and ask a real estate agent if you can buy it, because it doesn't exist. Okay? It only exists because of this characteristic of displacement on the maps. Okay, now the last of these properties that we need to do when we do cartographic generalization is exaggeration. So, let's start by saying we started by looking at the digital topography of the South Coast. And just take a look at that. Doesn't it look fantastic? You can see the satellite image draped over the digital topography. We're looking down on Santa Barbara Harbor in the foreground. The campus is out there to the left. We can see the Santa Ynez Mountains. We can see even where the San Marcos Pass goes over it. Look at the lowest point. Not the point on the screen. So if you're going to have to cross this Front Range, where would you cross it? Well, you'd... you go right about here where the lowest crossing is. There's Lake Kachuma, second mountain range out here, Santa Ynez Valley here. Doesn't that look realistic, everybody? Looks fantastic. It's complete baloney. Okay? On this map, the horizontal scale, latitude and longitude, has been set to 1 to 1. Okay? So 1 meter north is the same as 1 meter east and west. But on the vertical scale, has been doubled. So 1 meter up and down is 2 meters up. Okay. Why? Because the Earth is kind of flat, really, when you get to it, unless you're looking at the Tibetan Plateau or the Andes or something like that. Most topography on the Earth is kind of straightforward. It's not very detailed. But so what do? We exaggerate the topography so that we can see the detail that we want the map reader's eye to be drawn towards. Okay, and that could involve on the bottom. The bottom map there, we've got three different depictions of perhaps the same river system. The sort of purplish one is highly smoothed. We might have done that, say, with a mathematical function to smooth the distribution of the streams. The blue one looks a little bit more realistic, and it's got some wiggles and bends in it, and it looks kind of good. The most detailed one could be the actual depiction of the creek. If we took a tennis ball, put a GPS receiver inside it, and heaved it into the creek, and then took a point every second as it floated down the river, we might get the very thin blue line on that particular map. But if we then sampled and took, say, every tenth second or every minute, we might get the thicker blue line. And that might, as you can see, it's a very different looking kind of a line. The more simplified mathematical line is kind of a completely different depiction of the look of the stream. What Babs Buttonfield has called the character of the line, it looks completely different. Okay, so how much wiggliness to expect to see in a feature to believe that it's a road, or a railroad, or a stream? Obviously, we expect streams to be wigglier than, say, a railroad, where we can't have rapid turns. We have to go down around very gentle turns. Or an interstate highway, where the degree to which we can turn on the highway is actually, you know, it's actually a federal statute as to how steeply you can make any particular turn. So how much detail or how much wiggliness to expect to see? And often we put this wiggliness in artificially. We might want to see a very detailed coastline, so we make the coastline more detailed than it would normally be, or that would actually be if we'd sampled it in the real world. So we're often seeing exaggeration on maps, and especially around water features. This seems to be where we like to do them the most. Things like the boundaries of swamps, which can be relatively straightforward, often appear as very complex lines on maps. Okay, let me cover one more place where generalization has context, and that is that we think about generalization. Thank you very much. We think about, I like the musical accompaniment every once in a while. If we think about the geometric features on the maps, the points, lines, and areas, and simply are we selecting them, putting them on, whatever, no. We should also think about the attribute that we're depicting. So in this case, I'm showing you a land use map, and this is quite a detailed land use map in terms of what it's showing. So a good example would be here. We have wetlands shown on this map. There's three categories. We have wetlands, woody wetlands, and emergent wetlands. Well, you'd have to be a bit of an expert land use mapper or a botanist to be able to tell the difference between those three. Okay, so if I were going to map this, I would probably simply say a wetlands is a wetlands. Take those three categories and merge them into one. Okay, I've thrown away detail. I've done simplification in exactly the same way as if I'd straightened out a line or chosen a subset of points with which to depict a polygon. And this happens all the time, especially around things like residential land uses, industrial, commercial, forests. Forest fragments are often very, very fragmented because land's all been chopped up and cut up. And besides, it's a vegetation boundary anyway, and nobody has ever managed to make vegetation follow straight lines, or at least by its own accord. Okay, so the other kind of generalization, in other words, is attribute generalization, in which we're simplifying features as we put them onto a particular map. Okay, so here's the wrap-up slide for the lecture. Generalization is necessary. Why? Simplicity. Simplicity and clarity. If we didn't simplify the map, we wouldn't be able to read the map at the Coarser scale. The detail would overwhelm the message. So we have to throw away some detail to retain the clarity of the message. It's always necessary when scale changes. So the same, here's just simply the same feature, an island, at one to equivalent 25,000, one to 50,000, 100,000, 250,000. What we're seeing here is the fact that the extent also changes. So if we have a coarse map scale, the real estate on the ground is very much smaller. At this image here, I would challenge you to be able to see every single one of the wiggly little details of those islands, or even whether or not that island even exists, simply because of the size of the feature and the level of generalization that's being applied. Okay. These changes are profound because they take place in the five forms of generalization that I've just talked about, and some of them are necessary for clarity. Some of them are just straightforward cartographic lies. They buy the price of clarity, but if we actually go back and start measuring, as I did with the canal, we run into this problem of what happens where. So here's the summary slide for today. These things happen when we generalize, and they're all bad, okay? It's from a cartographic point of view. One, we select. We have to say, what do we leave off of the map if we don't have enough space for it? Two, we simplify. We say we can't fit every single little wiggle into this stream. How much wiggle can we fit in? How simplified can the stream be and I can still retain it on my map? Combination, like combining the Hawaiian Islands, an example that I gave you. How can I take multiple features and make them into single features and still make you believe that you're seeing the appropriate level of detail for the map? Displacement, the purest of the cartographic lies, where I can only see that there's a difference between symbols if I deliberately move them apart. You might say I destroy the geometric integrity of the map for the sake of clarity and readability. And that's often what you want. If you're trying to read a map on your cell phone, you want clarity. You don't particularly care whether it's 10 meters or 200 meters between the canal and the highway. And then lastly, we often, as we all tend to do, we often exaggerate, especially if you're into fishing. We exaggerate features on maps to make them more visible, make the message that we're trying to show more prominent. If the topography is important, and that's what we're showing, we might exaggerate the topography. If the exact characteristic of the highway is a wiggly country road with lots of hairpin bends, I might stick a few hairpin bends in there that don't even exist just to make it more hairpin-y and so on. Okay? This is the take-home for today, and I'll see you all in class on Wednesday.
Have you actually found, for the GeoPedia plugin, have you actually found a map that is like vectorized?